This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature.
Hi, Ratay. Welcome to episode 10 of the Antigone in 2019 podcast. My name is Mary, and in this episode, I will be discussing the significance of gender, blood bonds and mourning, the conflict between family and polis, and the mixed sympathies that follow, in lines 497 through 530 of Sophocles' Antigone. To give a bit of context before diving in, prior to the events in these lines, Antigone has been caught giving funeral rites to her brother Polynices, a thing forbidden in Thebes, and having been brought before Creon, she confirms her actions. I'd first like to point out the language that Antigone and Creon use here. Antigone employs a lot of words that refer to blood ties, such as homosplachnus, meaning kindred or brothers, on line 511, and on line 517, Adelphos, brother. She also states that it did not fall to her by nature to join in hating, but to love along with her brothers, as they love her, or loved her, rather. Emphasizing, at least from Antigone's perspective, the overriding value of their natural kinship. In contrast to Antigone, Creon describes the brothers Polynices and Eteocles in more political terms and more in relation to their actions, as in line 522, when he says that a man wants an enemy, Nekthros, does not, even if he's died, become a friend, Philos. Thus defining the brothers not in terms of their blood relations to him or to Antigone, but their actions as men and citizens. And he again uses language that is contrary to Antigone's in describing the brothers when he states on line 518, when responding to Antigone's argument that it was Eteocles' brother who died, stating that one brother, Polynices, died plundering their land while the other was defending it. According to Creon, a good, honest man does not get the same lot as a bad one, thus defining the brothers and their subsequent treatment by their character. Creon is speaking like a leader concerned with punishing a traitor publicly in order to set an example and so that there won't be any more civil war or insurrection. For Antigone, as our commentator Mark Griffith observes, the laws of Hades apply to everyone, even political enemies. Antigone appeals to the duties of kinship, whereas for Creon, these sorts of honors depend upon actions, particularly within the context of the polis. Here we can see the conflict between family and natural bonds and the polis, the law. The mistake that Creon seems to make here, and the one that leads to such conflict and tragedy, is trying to treat a private matter as if it were only a public one, in imposing the values of the city onto those of the family, and believing that a citizen could so easily abandon familial bonds and duties in favor of city obligations. This conflict brings up the question of how the rest of Thebes feels about this issue. Should duty to one's family outweigh duty to one's city? It can be difficult to decide which of these two is right, if either is, and which character the audience should side with, as both Creon and Antigone are justified in their decisions, even if they do eventually take them to extremes. There have been few regular characters in this play so far that could shed light on this issue, aside from the guard and the chorus. In this section, Antigone argues that the other Thebans are on her side, but that they check their speech out of fear of Creon, saying, on line 509, Horosi Kutoi, soi de hoop elusi stoma. They also see it like I do, but they check their speech because of you, because they're scared of you, you being Creon. In contrast to Antigone, Creon argues, with a little bit less support, that Antigone alone feels this way about him and his edict. The little that we see of and hear from regular Thebans makes this a fuzzy issue, and, as our commentator Griffith notes, contributes to our divided sympathies, and perhaps to Sophocles' intention. Given the significance of blood ties and familial piety in this passage and the play as a whole, as well as the associated struggles that arise, particularly in a family as closely related as this one, it is also worth discussing the importance of earlier blood relationships in gene and clans. As Bernard Knox observes in The Heroic Temper, Such relationships had been the dominating factor in a citizen's social and political life. They were older than the polis and, in democratic Athens, still had every sign of their continued power as a rival and even potential danger to the newer civil institutions and forms of organization. It is no accident the foundation of Athenian democracy was Cleisthenes' reorganization of the citizen body in local as opposed to family units. So the polis and leaders such as Creon understandably attempted to subdue these relationships in order to maintain city stability and cohesion. The citizens of a polis need to be loyal to their city first in order for this to work. But nature, and by that I mean the natural attachments and obligations to one's family, the need to honor them or avenge them, does not really operate this way. Going off of this, I'd like to discuss the significance of line 525, in which Creon states that as long as he is alive, no woman, a gune, and he specifically uses the word gune here, will rule. This gets at the gendered nature of familial and political spheres, the former being traditionally associated with the female and the latter with the male. Also, in the Heroic Temper, Bernard Knox states that in Aeschylus, the old primitive blood loyalty is associated throughout with the female, and the establishment of the civilized law and the polis with the male, with the polis being the thing that maintained order and stability. Sophocles was also living in this sort of world, and these associations are the same in Antigone, with the title character stressing her responsibilities as a blood relative and Creon emphasizing city loyalty over family. Continuing on this note of the spheres being gendered, women were especially associated with the family and, as a part of that, with lament, going through the process of and displaying mourning, such as beating one's breast or tearing one's hair, or probably something less dramatic than that, was particularly significant for women in this culture. Creon brings up the idea that valuing familial ties and therefore funeral rites is a more primal female thing, not the stuff of a ruler such as a woman, such as himself. He won't let a woman, and therefore a woman's obligation to mourn, rule. This is not the way for him to maintain order. He needs to show that traitors are punished in order to prevent another civil war. As Charles Siegel discusses in Sophocles' Tragic World, women's mourning helped the dead make the transition to the underworld, but it was also seen as a source of emotional violence and disorder. The control of this emotional energy was a continuing concern of ancient Greek society, and it is a recurrent subject of tragedy. According to Plutarch, in Athens, Solon even established laws to try and keep these wild lamentations under control. And isn't this public and rather violent display of pain and loss sort of terrifying? It also involves a loss of control and a return to something ancient, something quote-unquote primal, that would have been rather threatening to someone trying to organize a city body and maintain it. Even today, we tend to shy away from these types of displays. The only places in which they're somewhat permitted are funerals, and then only to a certain degree. I've seen this in my family, and we're maybe a little eccentric. Funerals for us are kind of like weddings, but with less dancing and more grudges. We joke, and we drink, and we laugh, and we tell stories in order to maintain a sense of order, to feel that things will not fall apart, that they are under our control. And this is what Creon and Sophocles is getting at here. If Creon allows a woman to rule, as he says, no woman will rule while I'm alive. So if he allows a woman to rule, i.e. primitive blood loyalty, he may not be able to keep the peace in his polis. So that is pretty much the end of the discussion part of this podcast. Before concluding this episode, I would like to talk about my experiences of being teacher of the day. I found this assignment really helped me examine the Greek more closely and think more deeply about what is going on in Antigone, what it means, and how I can use the Greek to effectively articulate my thoughts and support my ideas. I was initially worried that I would have trouble getting my students of the day involved in discussion passage with my various questions, that they weren't interesting enough or they didn't prompt enough discussion. But I was pleasantly surprised by how many of my students of the day participated and by how much I learned from them. They made a lot of comments and had a lot of insights that I would never have reached myself, even though I read this passage a myriad of times. I think that their insightful comments on the text are what I will remember most from this experience. Again, my name is Mary, and thank you for listening to the Antigone in 2019 podcast. Please feel free to let us know what you think by leaving a comment, and be sure to listen to the next episode.